Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to today's podcast. I don't have to tell you how many messages, interruptions, and distractions you're inundated with every day. Add to that the stress placed on so many of us by the many roles we play every day: parent, partner, friend, worker, citizen, and the very critical skill or quality of attention that helps us with all of these is really under siege these days. Daniel Goleman, the psychologist, journalist, and best-selling author who wrote the book on emotional intelligence, has a new book, Focus: The Hidden Driver of Excellence. In it, he delves into new, surprising findings from neuroscience labs and explains why attention is a little-noticed mental asset that makes a huge difference in how well we find our way in our personal lives, our careers, and in virtually everything we do. Like a muscle, you use attention poorly, it withers. Work it the right way, and it strengthens. But one thing that's interesting about Goleman's approach here is he doesn't merely consider the personal need for attention, but also looks at the way evolution has presented humans a challenge when it comes to dealing with long-term threats like climate change. We're going to talk about all of that when he joins me in a couple of moments. On Freeform, as you know, we explore the lives and the work and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, and provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, culture, media, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Daniel Goleman is a psychologist who reported on the brain and behavioral sciences for the New York Times for many years. His 1995 book, Emotional Intelligence, was on the New York Times bestseller list for a year and a half, with more than 5 million copies in print worldwide in 40 languages. He's co-founder of the Collaborative for Academic, Social, and Emotional Learning, originally at the Yale Child Study Center, now at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He also currently co-directs the Consortium for Research on Emotional Intelligence in Organizations at Rutgers. And some of his other books include Social Intelligence, Ecological Intelligence, Destructive Emotions, and his latest, and the one we're going to focus on today, pardon the pun, Focus: The Hidden Driver of Excellence. Welcome again to Free Forum, Daniel Goleman.
Thanks, Terrence. It's always a pleasure to join you.
Thank you. Thank you. Now, I like listeners to get a feel behind the people, behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. And so I gave that brief bio a couple of highlights. But can you tell us, in your own words, a bit about your personal path to the work that you find yourself doing today? And feel free to mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision, that sort of thing.
Well, it's funny you should bring it up, Terrence. I just started to write a kind of a memoir of my journey into all of this. And by all of this, I mean the applications of a trained attention, or the possibilities that open up to us with viewing the mind and attention as a muscle that can be developed. I started when I was a graduate student in clinical psychology. I had a traveling fellowship to India, and I studied different kinds of meditation. Meditation, in essence, is the retraining of attention. And when I went back to university, I did my dissertation on how this could help us, for example, recover more quickly from stress. And since then, there's been a huge explosion of interest in mindfulness, one kind of meditation, as a way to help people with serious medical problems they have to live with, they have to manage. Helps them manage it better because it takes the hurt out of the pain. For example, with chronic back pain, or it helps people get more relaxed and helps people pay more attention. I drew on this research, which in the last few years has really exploded with the application of brain imaging technologies to attention, when I wrote Focus. But that was really the culmination of a journey that started decades ago in India.
I do want to talk a little bit about some stops along the way. I read one of your bios recently, and you said that your main mentor in graduate school at Harvard was David McClelland. In fact, you and I, as we know, have met in one of his classes. I was an undergrad taking one of his grad classes. You were one of his graduate students, and I remember taking courses and doing weekend workshops and so on. Now, we don't hear his name much these days. Could you tell people Who was David McClellan, and what were his major contributions? And one thing I will say, just before to set that up, it seems to me that if he were doing the work he did in the late 60s today, he would be all over the media.
It's absolutely true. David was a fascinating psychologist, very open-minded, very innovative, and his specialty, his expertise, and what would make him fabulously popular today was his analysis of the drive to achieve, what made people successful entrepreneurs. In fact, he spent years in places like Ethiopia and India training people to think like successful entrepreneurs and found out that it actually helped them do better in business. And, you know, if this were happening in Silicon Valley today, he'd be on TED every other week.
Exactly. That's what he would be one of the top TED Talks.
Exactly. And David was also, and this is less known, had a very strong spiritual dimension. His wife, Mary McClellan, was from a very strong Quaker family in Philadelphia, and he became a Quaker. But then he became very interested in other forms of meditation. And, you know, for me, he was kind of a front man. He fronted for me on that traveling fellowship to India, where all I did really was study meditation, but I needed, you know, a faculty sign-off. He's happy to do it. Interesting side note, it was McClellan who hired and fired Leary and Alpert during their stay at Harvard. That was several years before I got there. But they had been in the same program that I was in, which David was a mainstay of. David was very, very well known and respected in the psychology of his time. But, you know, that kind of fame has a very short half-life.
Yeah, and also he didn't, and I think it's because not that many did at that time, he didn't write the popular versions of his academic work, as which now is a huge field. And I'm talking not about the Malcolm Gladwells and those sorts of folks who popularize, or even the work that you're doing, but the first-hand folks like Pinker, who now put out best-selling books. That wasn't so much the case when David was doing his work.
Well, in fact, I have some personal testimony about that. I went from teaching at Harvard to journalism. In the 80s, people in academia thought it was, practically an act of treason. What's a nice guy like you doing in a place like this? How could you squander your education on journalism? Science journalism, as we know it today, just did not exist. It was very rudimentary. I was one of the first to take that up as a field. And what happened, you know, I'd write an article once I was at the New York Times, say, about a psychologist and his work. You know, the next week he'd have a book offer for $100,000, a huge amount in those days, particularly for an academic. And academics started to realize that there was a very large hunger and interest in the general public for the implications for their lives of the work they were doing. And in fact, every grant for research has as a stipulation that you disseminate the findings that had been taken to mean you just write an obscure journal article. But now it's been expanded to, for many psychologists like Pinker, to mean, well, explain what's important about your findings to the general public, to the public at large, who's actually paying for the research through the government. And now that's quite commonplace, but when I started doing it, it was a little bit scandalous.
Yeah, I know. I had years and years ago when I interviewed the woman who wrote You Just Don't Understand, and I just blanked on her name, but that book was like Your Emotional Intelligence.
Gender differences in language.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But she had written two academic texts, and was that same thing when she finally wrote one that became, like Your Emotional Intelligence, a year and a half bestseller on the New York Times list. She had to go through that same thing of that you've left the faith, sort of. You've gone outside the monastery. You've fallen.
Well, yes. She said that because her book, I think it was called You Just Don't Understand.
That's right.
In that first wave of, you know, academic-based psychologists writing a book everybody could understand, and people loved it. But the culture of academia takes a long time to change, and it's taken, I think, a generational shift for it now to be rather commonplace.
Exactly. This is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Daniel Goleman, psychologist, former science journalist at the New York Times and bestselling author of Emotional Intelligence. And we're going to talk about his new book, Focus, The Hidden Driver of Excellence. And you can learn more at danielgoleman.info. Remember that it's .info, and Daniel Goleman, one word, is DanielGoleman. Okay, let me ask you one other thing. You mentioned that your doctoral research was on meditation as an intervention in stress arousal. Now, I assume this also was very much ahead of its time. What went into you thinking you could do that? How was it received? That sort of thing, because I just want to get people a sense of how this field has evolved.
Well, it wasn't a popular topic. In fact, it was looked askance at that you would bother with or take serious interest in something like meditation. It wasn't on the map in psychology at all. I was lucky in that Herbert Benson, who was at the medical school at Harvard, had just published some work on TM and blood pressure. He was a cardiologist. That somewhat legitimized the topic. He was on my dissertation committee, but there were people in my department who thought this was absolutely not just off the map, but a complete waste of time.
Right, right. Why aren't you doing good Western stuff?
Well, why are you doing the kind of research I do, really, is what they were thinking.
Why, exactly. Why aren't you doing what I do?
Yeah.
So now let's pull up. So you've talked a bit about your time at the Times, and then you write Emotional Intelligence. How did that book happen?
Well, I'd been writing about a whole wave of new findings on the brain and emotions, and I came upon a very obscure article, so obscure it was in a journal that no longer exists, and the article was called Emotional Intelligence. It was by a guy I knew, Peter Salovey, who now is the president of Yale University. Then he was a junior faculty at Yale, and one of his graduate students, Jack Mayer. And I was rather electrified by the term because it seemed like an oxymoron, you know, emotions and intelligence together. But I realized it means being intelligent about emotion, and I used that concept as a frame for a book which wasn't just about the idea of emotional intelligence, but also included, for instance, a lot of brain research. It allowed me to integrate that, as well as implications, particularly for education, and also a short chapter on management, managing with heart. That chapter, to my surprise, got huge interest among business people and led to some articles in the Harvard Business Review, and the education angle really got picked up and has now been embodied in a movement called social emotional learning, which is in tens of thousands of schools under many different names. But it means, in addition to the academic curriculum, you help kids be self-aware, manage their emotional life, their impulses, their drives, their motivation, empathize, understand other kids, get along. And it really improves the school atmosphere. Also, it happens to increase academic achievement by about 11%.
Okay. I think we'll talk about that a little bit when we talk about some of the applications later as we get into the book. So emotional intelligence comes out. It changes your life, I assume.
I quit my day job at the time.
I bet you did. Once you're on their bestseller list, you don't have to be in the back pages. What have you learned over the years that has enhanced or changed what you knew when you wrote that book?
Well, a lot of the new learning actually is in my new book, Focus. I realize that my old interest in attention has been revived and upgraded by the new research, and that attention has always been implicit in the emotional intelligence model. There are four components. Self-awareness, well, that's a kind of attention. Self-management, which flows from self-awareness. You can't do it if you're not aware of what's going on in yourself. And then empathy, which is attention to the other person, and that is the basis for managing relationships well, for influence, for persuasion, for collaboration, for teamwork, for leadership, for all those things. And so in Focus, I've redrawn and reconceptualized the emotional intelligence model in terms of an inner focus, which is that self-awareness, and an other focus, empathy, and drawn in a lot of the new research on attention and how it helps us understand more deeply what these abilities involve.
Okay. So let's turn to the new book, Daniel Goleman. Why did you call it focus? Why not attention? Is there a distinction?
Well, attention is a rather more technical term, and I wanted to be able to talk about focus in a variety of ways, not just the way attention researchers do, which becomes quite technical, but also in terms of ways that we would relate to it in our own lives, focusing on yourself, focusing on other people, and focusing on the wider systems that operate in our lives and that we operate on through our lives and that are extremely important. That's where I got very interested in, for example, the impact of our daily decisions on the environment, because they're vast, but they go unheeded. So the frame of focus allowed me to pay attention, if you will, to those other levels and varieties of attention.
Okay, that makes sense. So what I want to do is talk about – you've referred to some of them already, but let's talk about different forms of focus. So first there's – in terms of time scale, there's focus that has to do with the present moment, with immediate current actions, with decisions and that sort of thing. And then there's longer-term focus, might have to do with your path or your calling or that notion that you have of a rudder. Could you talk about a focus in terms of this dimension of time?
Well, yes. In the immediate present, how well we can concentrate on what we're doing, for instance, makes an enormous difference. You alluded in your intro to the constant distractions we live with today. You know, that's a new environment for attention, and the attentional system in the brain wasn't really well designed to handle that. We're easily distracted, and those distractions have an enormous cost in our ability to focus and concentrate on that one thing we have to do right now. Every time our mind wanders off to, you know, your new email, that text, whatever it is, you lose momentum, and it takes a while to get it back on that main task. So I think we're all fighting that battle, and it's important. For example, I recommend that we carve out for ourselves in a day a time when we can just have sustained concentration on one thing and ignore all the rest. That's in the short term. And in the more immediate, in the long term, a kind of inner focus that matters enormously is being able to attune to subtle signals that are a kind of ethical rudder. The way this works was spelled out by a neuroscientist named Antonio Damasio. He writes about what he calls somatic markers. He says that the part of the brain which registers as we go through life, you know, what we believe in, what works, what doesn't work, our entire life wisdom, is actually not accessible through conscious awareness, that it has access to the part of the brain that thinks in words indirectly through the gastrointestinal tract, has a lot of connectivity to the gut. And we get a gut feeling, and the answer to is what I'm about to do in keeping with my sense of meaning, purpose, and value in life. In other words, the ethical dimension comes to and it felt to us in the sense of it feels right or it doesn't feel right. And being able to attune to those somatic markers, to those subtle signals, means that we'll be able to make decisions more in keeping with what we actually believe in deeply. So it's very important for long-term decisions. You know, should I marry this person, or what goals really matter to me?
So this is one that's tricky for me to really to understand how it works. In other words, I understand and a great deal of the value of attention is in the present moment. And we'll talk a little bit about shifting from one thing to another and management sort of our attention. But how even the long-term thinking, as I said, like your path in life, what is your calling? What is your you know, objectives for the next 5 or 10 years, your career, any of those sorts of things. And yet, I think what you were just saying is that the signals are still in the moment to moment. The signals are still in this gut, this rudder, and so on. How do those two things fit together?
Well, I think that those signals of what's right and what's wrong are important for the kinds of questions you're talking about, questions of meaning, questions of purpose, because there are no objective right and wrong answers to that. It's not like you could look it up on Google.
That's right.
The only answer is in your internal rudder. What will I actually feel good doing going into the future? And you get a little preview of that with these gut signals in the present. So it gives you a reading, a barometer of how I will be if I make this choice. So the present actually gives you a taste of the future. Once you decide where you want to go, once you have a purpose in mind, a goal that feels good to you, then what keeps you moving toward that goal is a different brain system. It's in the left prefrontal area, and it activates a dopamine system when you picture yourself accomplishing that goal. And it's being able to access that that keeps us going toward that goal despite, you know, the obstacles and all the frustrations and so on. But you know it's going to feel good when I get there, so I'm going to keep going. So these inner signals are actually very important for long-term goals.
Absolutely. This is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. That's the voice of Daniel Goleman. You recall him as the science journalist of the New York Times for years and best-selling author of a number of books, Emotional Intelligence being the biggest. And we're talking about his new book, Focus, The Hidden Driver of Excellence. And you can learn more at Daniel Goleman. Daniel, just as it sounds, and Goleman, G-O-L-E-M-A-N, danielgoleman.info, I-N-F-O. Okay, that was looking at it in terms of scale. Then there's that other way of looking at these sort of distinctions in focus, which is which you've alluded to before, which is internal and external. Talk about that.
Internal and external.
Focus, attention, that focus that is that self-awareness, that internal one,
and then
the one on other.
Awareness. The next kind of focus is an other awareness, focusing on the person you're with. Empathy, in other words, being able to tune in, sense how that person sees the world. That's called cognitive empathy. Understand their mental models, the lenses through which they filter reality, and how they think about things, because that allows you to communicate in a way that that person will understand. The second kind of other focus is an emotional empathy. This involves a brain system that creates an instant rapport where you feel in your own body what that other person is feeling. It lets you be on the same page. It's the basis of chemistry, of those moments and interactions that we love so much because we feel so close to the other person. And then there's a third kind of empathy that I think is extremely important, underrated, not thought about that much, but it's called empathic concern. And it is the basis for compassion or caring. It means that you not only sense what's going on with the other person, but if they're in need, if you can help them, you do so spontaneously without, you know, a second thought. And, you know, this is what you want in your spouse and your friends and your boss, you know, and people who matter to you. And this is how you want to be with people.
And you even write about some sorts of entrainment where people end up in the same rhythms, right? Can you talk a bit about that?
You know, you see it at the highest level, maybe in a jazz group, a rap group, people who are in the moment extemporizing, but doing it in a way where they're totally connected. They're in the same rhythm. You know, they really have it. And you see it in people who are in a state of rapport, who are really locked into each other. And it's not just a metaphor. It actually is that their brains are firing in the same way.
Yeah, I think you talk about new lovers can be – I think you have a place there where someone talks about how a woman was picking up on these cues and she could tell that that her professor and one of his students must be having an affair just by the rhythm that they'd entrained in.
Well, yeah, she put it more vividly. She said, you know, when he'd wiggle, she'd wiggle. In other words, their bodies were – mimicking each other in a completely unconscious way. She happened to be super sensitive,
right,
and able to pick up those cues, which got her in trouble in other ways.
Right.
She didn't manage it well, but that's a story I tell in the book.
Yeah. So how much of the research that you have in Focus is new? And let me ask that two ways. In other words, it's pretty new if it's in the last 10 or 15 years. It means that whatever someone was taught in college about this stuff 20, 30 years ago has been updated. And then there's new, like, in the last year or two. How much of what you're writing about in this book is new?
I was surprised. Almost all of it is within the last couple of years.
Wow.
Last two or three years, there's been this explosion, this steep rise in the amount of research in this area. And I think it's because of the emergence of brain imaging and the access of cognitive science to brain imaging machinery. And so all of a sudden, people who had to use very indirect methods to study attention are watching what's going on in the brain right now while the person is concentrating or daydreaming and so on. So it's, in a way, it's a whole new science.
And it, what it allows them to do is map some of these things, and what they look at is, for instance, what section of the brain seems most active or lit up, if you will, when certain emotional and intellectual things are happening. Is that basically what they're looking at?
That's exactly right. It's brought much greater clarity about the difference between the varieties of attention. For example, when it turns out that there are three kinds of attention, each of which blocks out the other two. There's concentration. That's when we're getting, you know, we're totally focused on what we want to look at. There's mind wandering, which includes distractions and interruptions. If our mind is wandering, it kills concentration. If we're fully concentrated, there's no mind wandering. And then the third one is very interesting. It's full sensory awareness. If we're just out in nature, we're at the beach, you know, and just feeling the breeze and smelling the water and just immersed in the sensory world of our immediate present, our mind's not wandering, and we're not concentrated in the sense of task focused. It's a different brain circuit altogether.
That is fascinating. That something as open, that something that open could, even though it is open, close down the others.
That's right. It's, in a way, it's a kind of absorption,
yeah,
but it's not a concentrated absorption.
Can you talk here, because I think this goes right into it, about flow and how flow is Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi's, I once called it a theory, Daniel, and he corrected me.
I think he's down at the Claremont Colleges now.
That's right. But he said this is based on 35 years of observation. It's not a theory. but whatever.
A lot of data. Yeah, in flow, we are absolutely absorbed in what we're doing, whatever it is. It could be brain surgery. It could be a chess game. It could be a ballet. But our mind is fully, 100% focused on the present and the now. And as he's found, it's a state where people outdo themselves. We're at our best when we're concentrated. Turns out, actually, a study I cited that if you test levels of concentration in athletes, it predicts fairly well how well they perform in the coming season. The ability to bring our full awareness to whatever we're doing is absolutely crucial to being able to marshal our best talents.
Yeah, it's interesting because we hear coaches and we hear players in those after-the-game interviews and so on say, you know, we'll say, at this point it's all mental, you know. But what you're saying is it really is. In other words, the relative skill at the Olympics or the NBA is fairly close. And it's that ability that a Michael Jordan has or a Kobe Bryant that separates them more than their talent.
The very best players are calm, cool, and concentrated. And it's actually a tactic in the mental game to trash talk and try to upset your opponent because they're going to lose concentration. So, unfortunately, I think that tacitly encourages people being at their worst in a game in order to upset someone else so that they lose that focus.
Yeah.
That's the underside of the game.
Right, right. Okay, one other last thing I want to get in sort of laying out this foundation is that attention, and we're going to get into it also when we talk about systems thinking, but A lot of, we look at it now and we go, well, how did that serve us in evolution? Why did we evolve to do this? And one thing I would like you to mention is how humans in this regard differ, for as far as we know, from almost all or all other creatures, and then the role of evolution in the way attention works today.
Well, humans are quite unique in having a set of brain cells that are super quick, that are part of the attentional circuitry. And these brain cells are particularly important in empathy, for example. But our attentional circuitry is very tied to the workings of the emotional brain. The emotional systems were actually designed to help us survive in evolution. Strong emotions like fear or anger are designed to hijack attention so that we focus on the thing that's an emergency now and we deal with it. And when we do that, the emotional circuitry also flips the hierarchy on our memory system so that we remember whatever is relevant to the task and the emergency and threat at hand. Usually, classically, in evolution, this was a predator. And so we're very well attuned to, you know, the snarling dog, the screech of brakes, the whatever sounds.
Siren.
An immediate threat, sirens. Here's the problem. Today, the real threat is quite invisible to us. Our species is committing a slow suicide by our daily habits of the things we buy and do. And each of them, not in any way that we intend, but each of them has unintended consequences for the global systems that support life. The poster child for this is carbon. You know, when you drive to the store, when you heat your house, when you cool your house, you're sending into the air gases that are going to create a greenhouse effect that is slowly warming the planet. But it goes way beyond that. You know, there are 60,000 industrial chemicals that have never been evaluated for toxicity that are in random use today. Each of us carries 200 or 300 at measurable levels, many of which are now found to be carcinogens or endocrine disruptors. The way we're inexorably encroaching on jungle and forest to create farmland is killing species. I mean, biodiversity is a huge crisis. In other words, there is an unnoticed, almost invisible, planet-wide destruction going on because of the side effects of human systems of transportation, of energy, of construction, of industry and commerce. It's built in. None of us individually is guilty of having designed the system. A lot of these things, like our entire palette of chemicals, which come from petrochemicals, from oil, they were put together decades or more ago before anyone even knew about these consequences. So now that we know, I think we have to reinvent everything.
Yeah.
We have to rethink everything.
Yeah, we're going to talk about this, about systems and this leap you make from what I thought was going to be a book mainly focused on individuals to one of even societal and species attention. We're at about the halfway point. Let me tell people, this is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Daniel Goleman, former science journalist at the New York Times, best-selling author of several books, including Emotional Intelligence, about his new book, Focus, The Hidden Driver of Excellence. And you can learn more at danielgoleman.info. That's Daniel, and then G-O-L-E-M-A-N, one word, .info, I-N-F-O. So what you were just alluding to there is that evolution prepared us for immediate threats. You can see why, as you said, certain one kind of attention will override another in a crisis and so on. But when it comes to systems thinking, when it comes to sensing systems, when it comes to how everything fits together, which kind of is the foundation for what we're talking about if we're talking about global and societal issues, you say that we don't have a place in the brain that actually does that sort of attending.
Well, there's none that was specifically designed for that. We have to use the kind of generic all-purpose neocortex, the newest part of the brain, which learns. We have to learn how human systems interact with natural systems and understand it deeply and then pass that knowledge on to the next generation. This is how, you know, all human knowledge is acquired and how it's distributed. That's what education is about. But because the brain has no alarm system, it's even worse than no alarm system, we don't even perceive it. Our perceptual system was designed for the immediate threat, not for what's going on now on the planet. The changes are too macro, too large, or too micro. They're tiny. You know, it's at the molecular level. And so the human brain just doesn't perceive it. And so because we don't perceive it, and because our alarm system doesn't even care, is not wired for it, it's very hard, as environmentalists will tell you, to get large numbers of people to take action to do something to save the planet. Not only is it imperceptible, but the consequences are very far in the future. They don't seem to affect me, may not happen in my lifetime, and so it may happen in our children's or our grandchildren's, but not in adults' lifetime. So it's quite a hard sell. That's why, actually, I have a new analysis that I like a lot. It came from the Harvard School of Public Health on the motivational problem. When you tell people about their footprint, whether it's a carbon footprint or their the toxic chemicals, that footprint, or any of the ways we can do footprinting, it's very quite a spectrum, actually, of consequences that can be mapped and measured. It's very depressing. In fact, I have a friend who teaches this methodology at the School of Public Health there. It's called life cycle assessment. He says he asks his students to do a life cycle assessment of the impacts of their lives on the planet. And they basically come back to him and say, you know, the world would be better off if I had never been born. He says, that's the wrong conclusion. What you should do is take your footprint as the baseline and then focus on your handprint. Your handprint is all the things you do that lower your footprint. In other words, that improve that impact, that lessen it. You know, you ride your bike instead of driving. You take fewer trips. You don't take that plane trip. And that's a huge one. Or, you know, you recycle. Whatever it may be, you can measure that. You can measure the positive impact. And what you want to do is know what your handprint is today and keep growing your handprint, finding new ways to improve it in newer and newer ways. And that activates a very different motivational system in the brain. It's the system for success, for positive goals, not that negative system. When you talk about the footprint and how ugly it is, people get upset and they want to tune out. And generally, research from public health shows this. If you scare people about consequences or you threaten them and so on, they'll tune out. And you don't want that with a worldwide crisis like the environment. So I'm really trying to get companies, individuals, schools to pay attention to handprints, because the more we do, I think it will turbocharge the stop-and-go tendency now among industry in businesses to look at sustainability and find ways to become more sustainable. The main motivation so far has been things like saving on energy costs. It looks good on the bottom line, but where we need to go is to, as I said, reinvent everything. There were two guys, two undergrads at Rensselaer Polytech in upstate New York, had an assignment to come up with a new invention. They found a replacement for styrofoam. Styrofoam is a very ugly product. It's made out of oil. And it never dies. It just floats. And, you know, there's that huge circular vortex in the middle of the Pacific of plastics and styrofoam and stuff. That it tends to go to the middle of large bodies of water, of oceans, and kill fish. So they came up with a styrofoam that's made from rice husks and mycelium. That's the roots of mushrooms. And it turns out that the styrofoam does everything that the old-style styrofoam does. General Motors now is using their styrofoam behind the dashboards of their cars. Who knew there was styrofoam behind the dashboards of cars? But still, this is really a model. It's called biomimicry. It's using nature's way to get done the things we need to do instead of imposing on nature a way of doing things at great cost.
Yeah, no, I've done several shows on biomimicry with Janine Benyus and with others and so on. And for those who this concept is new to, it goes back to something you said a little bit earlier, Daniel, when you said that many of these systems, our construction system, our transportation system, our energy system and so on, was designed or emerged, you know, who knows how designed it was, but it emerged at a time when the consequences were either not apparent or we didn't know what they would be. And so now we have to change. What Janine points out is that almost everything in our processes calls for beating, heating, or treating. That is, you have to use enormous pressure, enormous heat, or you know, very intense solvents and that sort of thing to make chemical reactions happen. Well, nature, of course, in most of its stuff, does none of these things and yet comes up with, whether it's the ceramic in an abalone shell or the tensile strength of a spider web and so on, and that we had perhaps the luxury of designing things the way we did before without looking at how nature did them. But at this point, that's the big redesign that I see has to happen, is we have to say, well, if nature accomplishes it without those three processes which produce most of the side effects, most of the pollution and so on, how can we begin to do the same thing? It's huge. And are you familiar with the book New World, New Mind by Ehrlich and Ornstein?
Yes, a little bit.
Well, I went back in 1988, which is quite a while ago, was when they wrote this book. And what they basically said is the point that you make in your book, which is that evolution did not equip us for long-term consequences or of widespread consequences or any of that sort of thing. And that what we needed, we couldn't wait for evolution to catch up. We needed conscious evolution, and that's their solution. What I see in what you're talking about with the footprint and the handprint and with some of the other things is finally not just, oh, the solution is conscious evolution, but some actual methods and tools that can actually help us do that. Would you speak to that just a bit?
Well, I think it's true. When you look at each of the three kinds of focus, and just to make it explicit, I've been talking about outer focus, the focus on the systems that we affect and that affect us. If you look at inner focus and other focus and outer focus, there are methods for getting better at the key skills in each of those. And to go back to my earliest interest, meditation is training in attention. And in managing attention, and it's actually a direct workout for this mental muscle. There was some research done at Emory which showed that if you look at a meditator's mind, you'll see a basic repetition. It goes like this. You focus in one way or on one thing, your mind wanders, you notice it wandered, and you bring it back. That is, in the mental gym, exactly equivalent to reps with weights in the fitness center. Every time you do that, you strengthen the circuitry for paying attention. And this means that there's a method for enhancing that inner awareness, and not just in a kind of anecdotal way, but in a very brass tacks, we're going to thicken the circuitry, make it more active, make it stronger, make you better able to hold your attention where you want it and how you want it. When it comes to that outer awareness, I think that, for example, focusing on the handprint and getting smarter about how we spread the information, not only making impacts transparent. We have a methodology for that. I mentioned it before, life cycle assessment. It's used routinely now in industry, but the data is kept proprietary.
Mm-hmm.
Companies will do a life cycle assessment of a product. They want to see what they can do to save a little money. But they're not going to tell their competitors, so they don't publish that information. But there are ways to allow companies to share that information without giving away the secrets they want to keep for competitive reasons. And what that would do is create a database that would allow us to evaluate all the stuff we buy in terms of its impact on the planet and to make choices for better, more sustainable products. The methodology is there, hasn't been picked up. There is one very good website, actually two I can think of. One is GoodGuide, GoodGuide.com. It uses LCA methodology to evaluate tens of thousands of consumer products. It's now owned by Underwriters Laboratory, not for profit. And it's very useful if you really care about how your buying decisions matter. Another is called Skin Deep. It rates the toxicity of tens of thousands of personal care products like lipstick, toothpaste, eyeglass, and so on, and ranks them according by track. You know, there might be 50 ingredients in your shampoo. You never heard of 49 of them. And it looks in medical databases to see if they're known to be carcinogens or endocrine disruptors or so on, and rates the toxicity level of competing products so you can make smarter decisions for yourself. Well, why don't we have that for everything, and why isn't it immediately apparent to us as we're buying it? That would be the ideal. In order to make that happen, I think it would be incumbent on us to educate our kids so they thought in terms of systems from the get-go. This wasn't some exotic thing. It was embedded in their math, you know, in every subject. And it can be. By the way, there's some schools now that are doing this very successfully. And not only systems thinking, but using this kind of data to come up with your own footprint, with your handprint, and growing your handprint. You know, schools can compete on their handprint, not just football. I mean, that's a kind of utopian vision, but I'd love to see it happen.
Yeah, let me just mention a couple of things. One, when we're talking about life cycle analysis, what Daniel's referring to says that not only is it the obvious, in other words, the obvious thing of how much waste will happen if I throw this into a landfill or so on, but by life cycle analysis, how much energy did it take to in the manufacture, how much waste was there in the manufacture, taking it from the pulling stuff out of the ground that might go into it to ultimately either recycling it or discarding it. And when you talk about life cycle analysis, it's looking at all of those contributors, the transportation, the energy, the water, and so on, that might not be obvious. And what you're talking
– two quick examples.
Yeah.
If you recycle the plastic container that your yogurt came in, you remediate 5% of the carbon from that. Most of it is out of sight. It's on farms. It's in the trucking that moved the, you know, the milk and the yogurt and so on through its life cycle. And it's cows that are eating the wrong kind of feed and so have a lot of methane that they're putting out, which is an even worse greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. The other example is a glass, like a glass jar. Through an LCA lens, that has almost 2,000 discrete steps. Several of them have to do with a caustic soda that you added to a mix of chemicals and sand before you heated it for 24 hours at a very high temperature. Well, heating it at a very high temperature, of course, is a terrible output of probably the biggest output of carbon, but each of those steps can be analyzed for a spectrum of consequences way beyond carbon, you know, particulates, what gases were emitted or what chemicals were involved and got into air, water, and soil at each one of those steps. So you can even calculate what's called a DALY. A DALY is a disability-adjusted life year, which means when someone in that factory was exposed to that heating process and the off-gassing during it, how did that impact their health? And how much of a year will they be disabled eventually because of that exposure? I mean, it gets very, very specific. And so we can know, have a huge amount of data about just a common object like a glass. Right now, we have zero.
Okay. I think that's Daniel Goleman. We're talking about his new book, Focus, The Hidden Driver of Excellence. What I'd love you to talk about right now is some of the wonderful work being done in education. Some of it has to do with educating kids with systems thinking, as you said, in the handprint. But some of it has to do with mindfulness. Some of it has to do with empathy. Just some of the things that are going on that actually takes what we're learning and turns it into something which may make this next generation more able, where their focus comes into play.
Well, I think that the platform we can build on is what's called social-emotional learning. This is the education models that are in tens of thousands of schools based on emotional intelligence, helping kids be more self-aware, handle their inner life better, their impulses, their emotions, empathize well with other kids, and get along. These programs, I think the next generation will see an addition, which is attention training, which is being able to help kids be more mindful, to concentrate better, to build that attentional muscle of the mind. And the exercises for doing that are getting very, very clear. And I've seen, for example, second graders in Spanish Harlem do a simple, you know, 5-minute meditation exercise. They lie on the floor. They put a little stuffed animal on their belly. They watch it rise and they watch it fall. They count 1, 2, 3 on the in breath as it rises, and 1, 2, 3 on the out breath. And what they're doing is strengthening their attention. And the kids love it, and the teachers love it, because the kids are more focused and more calm during the rest of the day. I think that that is going to be part of the next generation in social-emotional learning. And I think at the other end, the outer focus, that we also need to consider how to bring this systems understanding into the curriculum in a very integrated way. So it's part of your science. It's part of your math. Definitely part of environmental science. It's not just that you go to the local river and understand the river system, but you understand how your life relates to water, relates to carbon, relates to industrial chemicals building up in the environment, and so on. So I think that is what we can add into our educational system as it exists now to help prepare kids to be better citizens when they grow up.
Now, you're talking about something which may sound to someone like, you know, pie in the sky, but let's say that this movement begins. But there's places practicing it now, and there are results, right? This is not soft anymore. There's some actual research projects and results that say this stuff works. Could you talk just a tad about that?
First of all, with the basic platform, social-emotional learning, they did a study, a meta-analysis, involving 270,000 students, comparing those with it and whose school didn't have it. And they found that in schools with the program, pro-social behavior, liking school, going to class, not cutting class, feeling someone there likes, cares about you, and so on, went up 10%. Antisocial behavior, fights and misbehaving in class and so on, went down 10%, even more in the schools that needed it the most. And the academic achievement test scores went up by 11%.
11%, that's significant.
That's very significant. It means that it helps kids learn better. So if you add concentration training, which means that kids can focus more on what the teacher is saying, you also bulk up what's called cognitive control. Cognitive control is the ability in a child or an adult to do that one thing now that's more important and ignore impulses and distractions. Get to them later after you're done. The cognitive control predicts financial success and health in adulthood better than IQ or better than the wealth of the family you grew up in. It's enormously important to help kids with this, and we now have the way to do it. That's what they're doing in that classroom in Spanish Harlem.
Wonderful.
Let me
ask you.
We've got the methodology.
Right. So if I give you 30 seconds, where can listeners learn more? What's out there if people are excited about this?
Well, I have some audio instructions on concentration and attention and empathy. They're available from More Than Sound, one word, morethansound.net. If you're interested in social-emotional learning, Collaborative for Academic Social-Emotional Learning, CASEL.org, or danielgoleman.info is my website.
And it will link to all of these things, that is, programs that you can get, as well as programs that are taking place in schools and so on. As I said, I found the book exciting because I thought it was just going to be a book on, you know, the individual and attention. But you really I shouldn't have been surprised, but you really take in both the organization. There's a lot of section on what makes good leaders and what their focus skills are that make them particularly tuned to leadership. And then, as we said, as we talked about a lot in this conversation, the whole broad spectrum of how society what a society pays attention to, and what that all means. So the book is Focus, The Hidden Driver of Excellence. You can learn more at danielgoleman.info. And thank you, Daniel Goleman. And as always, keep up the good work.
Terrence, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye. For this week's conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to TerrenceMcNally.net. That's TerrenceMcNally, TerrenceMcNally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and four or five articles of background, you can sign up at my site. Or you can email me at T.E. McNally, T.E.M.C.N.A.L.L.Y, T.E. McNally at mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes. Thanks to G, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi in production, and to you, my listeners. I look forward to being with you again next week.